So with that then, Mike and Margaret will talk about some of the challenges of Congress. You've had the energy thing now. They're going to talk more about some of the general aspects of their duties and challenges and probably answer questions.
Thank you, Leo. I particularly appreciate that invitation and the comment about this being a team operation. Someone has said that behind every successful man there's a good woman and a surprised mother-in-law. Certainly, it just wouldn't, the whole operation would never have been possible if it hadn't been for Margaret. I don't think she ever knew what she was letting herself in for.
No, that's true.
I think if 25 years ago I ever said to Margaret, now our goal is to get the Congress and you're going to be a congressional wife, she would have committed hara-kiri right on the spot. But we've sort of grown into this thing together, learning as we went along, because literally we didn't know a single soul in the state of Washington when we moved here after the Second World War, and so it really has been a team operation. I'm going to take off this morning and tell you a few things, and then we're going to turn over to Margaret, and then we'll just sort of throw the thing up in the air, and everybody can ask questions about anything they want. One of the problems that we had, we went over after breakfast and sat down and scratched out some notes that I have here, and I think the most striking thing in our minds was how difficult it is for us to describe, to see Congress through somebody else's eyes, through others' eyes. Now, after having been involved and actively in partisan politics and legislative work for 20 years, and in the Congress for 5 years, and having it be so totally consuming our lives, and that's really what it is, it totally consumes you, it's difficult for us to even see the questions. So I want to tell you a few things and then just open it up for questions and from your part. First of all, I think there's a basic attitude towards this whole thing. Now, the Greek word politikos means servant of the people. And this is where the word politician comes from. And I think far more than the American people tend to realize, this is the best possible description of an active public elected official, a politician, is a servant of the people. We tend to see oddballs and characters and dishonest people and demagogues and miss the other 99% of the hardworking public servants that are day after day trying to do their job, serving their society and serving their fellow men in this way. Because it is a high calling. Virtually all the social reforms that have been accomplished in the history of this country have come through the House of Representatives. There are a few exceptions, but most of them have come there. I think it's important to recognize that when you walk into the House of Representatives, in a very real sense, this is the citadel of democracy. It's a shrine of freedom, because you can count the number of democracies that have survived more than 50 years on the fingers of your hands. And our democracy has survived because, in a very real sense, it has been a place where the people govern and govern, I think, themselves very well. And there's another word that comes from the Greek that's a rather interesting word. It's called the idios. The idios were those who were deprived of the right to vote. They could not participate. They were the non-citizen class. And from that we get our word idiot. And somehow I think there's a message to be drawn there between the word idiot and those who do not vote. And I'll let you draw your own conclusions from it. Now, this world has undergone tremendous changes in recent years. All of us can look back to the time when we were very young and remember what life was like then. And remember the changes that have taken place around us during our lifetimes. I remember looking up at one single light bulb dangling from a room. Now everybody stood around up and looked at it and thought how wonderful it was. Well, Congress has changed too, in very much the same way. And one of the most important things that every citizen in this country could do would be to understand how it's changed and what it's really like today. Because fiction and movies and even news reporting tends to lag way behind these changes. We go back to 1920, near the time when I was born. The Congress of the United States was essentially a WASP organization. It was a white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant organization made up primarily of lawyers who came for brief sessions to the Washington, D.C., spent most of their time at home, had a very light workload, had perhaps one staffer, lent on occasion over to the House chamber to listen to orations that somebody had spent weeks preparing, had all their finances in secret. Most of them were being paid by big business of some sort and being supported or sponsored one way or the other in various degrees of by varying degrees of ethical standards. And this is what Congress was like when I was born. In 1975, the Congress is a homogeneous, totally open organization, absolutely unheard of thing of having women and blacks and black women and young, good-looking women as members of Congress. This was something that was absolutely unheard of. Today we have young, single girls as members of Congress. We have all religious groups thoroughly represented. We have a very open organization. Almost nothing that goes on anywhere in Congress is hidden from public view. Time was when Congress was an autocracy, when the Speaker was the absolute ruler, when Cannon was Speaker back early in this century, even when Sam Rayburn was Speaker. The Congress was an autocracy run in secret, and the people weren't able to follow what's going on. Calvin Coolidge said that Congress is a collection of committees that meet on occasion to approve each other's deliberations. And this is very, very much a true description, because Congress is made up of 435 members from 435 districts that are vastly different and separated from each other. And if you assume that every single member of Congress from those 435 districts is totally honest and totally responsible and totally dedicated, you still have such divergent districts and such divergent interests that conflict would be inevitable. And of course, any of you who remember Mr. Parkinson and Parkinson's Law know how crazy the idea would be of putting 435 people in a room and having them arrive at any decision or design anything. And yet that is what the Congress is designed to do. And so it is, as Winston Churchill said of democracy, the worst form of government there is, except for any other. This is the format, and this is the background in which we live. I'm going to take a couple of minutes more. Should I go ahead and go through this process?
Sure.
Just tell you a little bit about what it's like. There's almost everybody that comes back to Washington, D.C. to spend any time, if they're with us for just a little while, they come and they shake their heads and say, "My God, I never knew it was like this." And what they're talking about is the pace we keep and the schedule we keep and the things that happen to us during any given day. I had a newsman who was going to write an expose on Congress. We have a lot of young people who visualize themselves as great social reformers, and they come back to Washington, D.C. to write about it. And I had a fellow who came back, and he came in on Sunday night. He was there early Monday morning, and he said, "I'm going to follow you around for this week, and I'm going to write a story." And Tuesday, about 7 o'clock, he came to me and he said, "I want to apologize." That was after 2 days. And I said, "What do you want to apologize for?" And he said, "I want to apologize for what I was thinking when I came here." He said, "I never dreamed it was like this." He said, "I can't even keep up with you physically, let alone intellectually." And this is really the most significant fact of life about Congress. I just want to tell you a little bit about what it's like. Margaret and I sat down and wrote this schedule. We get up about 6 o'clock in the morning, run through an exercise routine at home, read the newspaper, because the Washington Post is almost the Bible. You have to read it to know what's going on. We'll listen to the morning news, plan our day, eat our breakfast, try to get to work by 8 o'clock. On the average, I will have about 3 breakfasts a week that I have to go to in order to meet somebody that I can't get to any other time. We have a dining room up in the Capitol building, and so when I can't squeeze anybody in at any other time, we have an 8 o'clock breakfast. On the average, I will have 2 committee meetings each morning. That's on the average. Now, going to a committee meeting is a far greater responsibility than one would ordinarily believe, because when you have a committee meeting, it means people coming in to testify from all over the country, experts who have spent months or years accumulating material to come in and give testimony. It may be 20 pages of typewritten material, and if you're fair to the person, you're going to have studied that material and know what he's talking about, understand the subject, and be ready to ask intelligent questions. It is nearly physically impossible. On the average, if I took them all, I'd eat 2 lunches a day. This would be just about the average that we would have. Actually, almost every lunch is with somebody, either over sandwiches in the office or over in the house dining room. I never go out to lunch because we don't have time. We have a dining room right underneath the house chamber, and we can get to and from the dining room and up to the house chamber very quickly when the bells ring for us for quorum calls or for us to be present to vote. On the average, in a morning, I'll receive about a dozen long-distance telephone calls, mostly from the state, various people wanting to talk to me about various subjects. As many of these as we can, we shift over to the staff people that are there, give that call to whatever specialist is handling the subject matter the person wants to talk about. On the average, I'll have 4 or 5 drop-ins, people that just suddenly walk into the office and say, here we are, families from home and this sort of thing. They want to talk to you and want to know where to go and what to see and this sort of thing. And of course, one tries his best to be hospitable. Sincerely, you want to be hospitable to these people, but sometimes it's a terrible problem when you're rushing out to a committee and you're late and you got your questions in your hand and you close the door and you bump right into a bunch of people from home and say, hi, Congressman, here we are. And then you have the problem of how you really are try to be courteous and gracious and respond to their needs, and at the same time look at your watch and say, that committee meeting is going on and I should be there. In addition, of course, we have people who want to come and see us, who want to say, now, at that committee hearing that you had last week, the testimony was as follows, but I have done an analysis, and I've got 5 pages of analysis that I want you to understand. It's terribly important that you understand this analysis. Would you come and sit down with me and talk it over? And this we have to try to work in. We go into session every day at noon, except for June and July this year. We went in most of the time at 8 o'clock, at 10 o'clock in the morning. This meant that we were running the session over the top of the time we normally meet at committee, so we're having committee meetings and general session in the House at the same time, which is very bad, because then we've torn back and forth between the two. The session normally runs during a normal day over the year about 5 hours, in other words, from noon to about 5 o'clock in the evening. But through July and August, it was running about 8 hours, from average from about 10 to 6, maybe 10 to, and later on, it was running 12 hours a day. In the afternoon, we'll have, on the average, maybe 3 days a week, another committee meeting. And then we have the mail. Now, on the average, I get a couple of hundred letters a day. And many of these be personal letters and people who want personal answers. We have a significantly sized staff there. One of the things that's different about Congress today as compared to a few years ago is that because of the tremendous involvement in federal programs in people's lives, we have thousands and thousands of people in every congressional district that have personal interrelationships with the federal government, and there's a significant percentage of them that wind up with some sort of a problem, and we call this casework. This is senior citizens on Social Security whose checks are stopped or they're wrong, or veterans who have problems with the Veterans Administration, people who want to get into the military service or people who want to get out of the military service, Farmers Home Administration, all kinds of federal matching programs, revenue sharing programs, aid to education programs, aid to handicapped children programs, aid to minorities programs, highway programs, reclamation programs, flood control programs, and all these things where we're working with city government, county government, flood control districts, port districts, and this sort of thing, trying to work with them. So I was talking to Hal Holmes, I'll take it back. When Tippi Dye was in Congress at the time of Calvin Coolidge, and he wrote about it then. He said that the average congressman had 1 staffer, and he said we'd come in the morning, and we might have a few pieces of mail, or we might not, and then we'd go over, we'd have a committee meeting perhaps, then we'd go over and sit around and listen to orations, and then we'd drift away in the afternoon, and the men would congregate in boarding houses and hotels and play dominoes and checkers in the evening, or go maybe go listen to a concert. Calvin Coolidge used to take a nap every afternoon, then have a garden party or something like that in the lawn or the White House, or in the East Room of the White House in the afternoon or the evening. Today, Hal Holmes, when he was in office, he was my predecessor once removed in this district, in the 1950s, had four staffers. They said they got about a dozen pieces of mail a day. Right. They handled it very nicely. They traveled back and forth by train. Was there in Washington, D.C. about 6 months and home about 6 months. Today I have I have 18 staff, and I bootleg some more. We put one person on for 1 month and take them off and put somebody else on them, and bootleg college students. So I have about 20 staff people working for me. We have four offices here in the state of Washington, one in Wenatchee, one in Yakima, one in Redstone, one in Vancouver. We have the office in Washington, D.C. We're handling in the district by telephone more than 2,000 personal cases a year, individual cases of persons who can't solve their problems with the federal government some other way. In addition, of course, we have people just assigned, for instance. I have one who's assigned to reclamation, agriculture, and highways. One's assigned to labor, education, and social services. One's assigned to military affairs. These are staffers who specialize in nothing else but this in Washington, D.C. And the conversation in Washington, D.C. these days is constantly, where does this thing end? Where does this thing end? It gets worse and worse and worse. The evenings, I stopped when I said I got the mail and this sort of thing, the telephone calls back to the district, because on the average you hear about two affairs of some sort, receptions, dinners, meetings of some sort in the evening. These things literally have a session with my secretary. I have a scheduling secretary every day that goes through the invitations of what we can take and what we have to reject, and we reject 3/4 or 7/8 of the invitations. Take the ones that we feel we must or we would like to attend. So whether people from the state participate. These can be anything from very simple receptions right there in the House office building with maybe the Rural Postal Delivery Service. People have come back to Washington, see the lobby, and they want us to come over and have a drink with them, or have a shrimp with them or something like that at 5 o'clock in the evening. Or maybe it's a state dinner at the French embassy. And the French were recently, they had a team over here studying our nuclear energy program, and they invited Margaret and me to the French embassy for a formal dinner with 40 people. Or maybe it's a White House reception or something like this. And the whole spectrum of activities. Maybe it's downtown to meet with the American Legion National Convention or the Veterans of Foreign Wars or the National Education Association, where you put in 2,200 people in one room.
One room.
And have over 2,000 people having dinner together.
Noisy affair.
Usually then, I take a briefcase full of material home to read, and we try to get to bed by 11 o'clock, and this is the way it goes. It's an extremely heavy workload, and this is more the best description of it, if anything I can give you. Well, I'm going to stop there.
Let me say about the mail. We get mail four times a day, and it's tied with a heavy cord, and it's about that deep.
And this is personalized letters and letters of information, technical material, analysis of bills before us, letters from other members. Are called Dear Colleague letters. So one member will write to everybody else and say, Dear colleague, I'm going to submit an amendment that says as follows, will you support my amendment? Anything from that to a lady giving, well, you have no idea how many letters we get from people who are 75 years old saying, Dear congressman, this is my budget, $4.87 for food for this week, $20 this week for rent, and this sort of thing. And it comes out to, my budget comes out to $141.14, but my income is only $108. What do I do? You get a lot of those. And those are tough letters to handle that. But you get this entire mix of stuff, everything in between. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. Well, we set a scene here now for perhaps we'd like to try to answer any questions you have about Congress or about issues or this sort of stuff. I don't want to get involved in a heavy discussion about energy this morning because we did it last night, but on other things I think it'd be more fun.
You've got so much energy we don't need to discuss it.
Congressman, what is the percentage today of representatives and senators who are attorneys?
I can't give you an answer, but it's far too high. There let me say, I want to say in all sincerity, I don't say this in any smug way at all. I think it's a tragedy that we don't have a broader spectrum of professions in Congress. But there's a natural selection in the political world that says that people that run for partisan political office at the state level, at the local and state level, are primarily those who can afford to do it. And those are primarily people who are independently wealthy or work for themselves, or whose professions will be advanced by their doing so. And of course, this means attorneys first, and then real estate people, insurance brokers, a few farmers, some housewives, this sort of thing. But very few people who work for somebody else. And this is one of my complaints. People say, gee, they introduced me as being only one of two scientists in the House, which in a technical sense is true. And I try not to say, gee, isn't it, look at me, how wonderful I am. I say, look at the situation, how bad it is. About 25% of the people who are considered to be our founding fathers, who signed our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, consider themselves to be scientists. Now we have two of us, and we're handling questions of far greater complexity, technical complexity every day, without having the ability to do it. And attorneys, and I must say, I went to law school for a couple of years, a few years ago, and so I'm sort of a half-baked attorney in a sense. They are not trained to solve problems. They are solved to win. They're not trained to solve problems. And they, not only do we have too many of one profession and not enough of another, but with the kind we have, there are not really problem solvers nearly as much as we need. I would guess it's 50 to 60%. Yes.
I never thought I'd find something in Calvin Coolidge's machine that would be nice, but after your incredible case, there's something about what happened then that sounds like it might build for more efficiency in the operation of Congress. Is there some action being taken to improve the time that you have to work so that you can be more efficient?
We thought about this. There's been a lot of discussion about this. We've just gone through a whole lot of congressional reform within the House of Representatives, trying to reorganize our committee structure and avoid overlaps. And after a great deal of agony and work, we found that it has been only, it's had only limited success. We have more subcommittees now than we had before, which was deliberately designed. It was to take the power away from a few and spread it among many more members. And in this we were successful, but it hasn't lightened our workload. Inherently, a 435-member body is going to be chaotic and inefficient, and the more democratic it is, the more chaotic and more inefficient it's going to be. And we are deeply concerned with this. We're deeply concerned with the pressures that are put on us. We try to answer this by developing specialized staff. But then does one answer the problem of the natural need that every member feels for having competence in most major categories on his own staff? So we have objection to having very large staffs. I don't have any solution to this problem. It's something we've been kicking around quite a bit. Incidentally, I don't know if you recognize this or not, but there are more than 60 members of Congress, about one out of seven, quit last year. They just said, oh, the heck with it, I can't stand it anymore. They got out. And when you realize what an exciting activity this is, and the fact that it does pay well, and the fact that most everybody would say, boy, I'd like to be a member of Congress, and when one out of seven quits, you realize that there's something wrong. And this is symptomatic of that problem.
There's a lot more of them talking about quitting. Oh, it's a terrible pace. And also, you're so compressed in a room. You've got three people every 10 square feet or something.
We literally have our desk touching in our room. So just that close.
Yeah. You've increased your secretarial staff, but so far you still have only one wife.
Let Margaret handle that.
Well, isn't it not so much efficiency, but the matter that we as people have turned to the federal government mm-hmm. for more and more of our problems or help, and therefore the federal government is so much more intimately involved with our lives, and unless we're willing to take back some of our responsibility personally, it's a never-ending thing.
Well, one would think so. I think we're in the midst of very, you know, major transitions in our social structure. We see this today all around us. When we were kids in the Midwest, the culture was built around homestead. You know, there was an agricultural area and there was a homestead, and everybody, whether it was the the family that was running the farm, or the parents, the grandparents, the maiden aunts, the orphan kids, or whoever it was home. And it was a home, domestic-centered society. And today, the fact that we have automobiles has changed that completely, and we've gotten into what I would call a society-centered culture. Everybody belongs to the entire society, so to speak. And when you try to handle those problems, the governmental structure at the local level generally isn't set up to handle them. There's no doubt about the fact that our governmental structure is extremely inefficient the way it is to handle today's problems. If we had the courage to analyze our structure of government from local through state and federal, and weren't afraid and consider ourselves, all right, we're going to be courageous, we're going to keep the things that are good and change the things that are out of date, we would undoubtedly make dramatic changes in our governmental structure. But we don't have the courage to try it. Few people have the courage to discuss it.
Mike, yes. Isn't one of the problems today is that too many congressmen think that the local government can't solve problems.
With some justification.
Well, you don't let them try.
Well, we could get into a long discussion on this, and we'd be dealing in generalities, unfortunately. We have been pushing as much as we can to get the local governments involved and try to upgrade local government by giving them more responsibilities. But the one thing that most federal programs that provide money for local programs, one thing that they have in common is that they set standards, minimum standards, and some sort of an oversight responsibility. If this weren't done, we would have a great deal more corruption than we now have at local government. I think it's terribly important that we be real honest about this thing. There are an awful lot of people in local government who are honest, sincere people who are doing a good job, just as there are at every other level. But the smaller the governmental unit, and the more it is away from expert oversight, the more it tends to corruption. And your county courthouse is the most inefficient and the most corrupt element of government we have. It is indeed. Yeah, that's a categorical statement, and I will stand behind it. And it may not be true in my district, but it may not be true in yours. But this is the pattern, and this is why that when we appropriate money for education programs, for instance, we have to say these are minimum requirements. Or if we appropriate money for matching funds for highways, we say we will have inspection and these things. And these are problems. There isn't any question about the fact. But you see, the federal government doesn't normally take things away from the local government. It simply says, here's a program, whether it's for handicapped kids or highways or flood control or even environmental protection. We will have these programs will provide the funds, and we'll provide them to the state government or the local government if they will meet these standards, and we will oversee that they do. And here and there, there's a county that says, to heck with it, we don't want your money. We're going to do it our own way. But mostly, of course, because we have such a terrible struggle with local government raising adequate funds, then they say, okay, we want your money, and so therefore they have to comply with the federal standard. It's a tough situation. I don't deny that at all.
In your reform, have you done much about the seniority concept of chairmanship and committee?
Yes, we have substantially broken that. If you recall, well, in my second term, I was chairman of a major subcommittee. That was 1973. This year, in 1975, we took out three major subcommittee chairmen. Congressman Pogue of Texas was chairman of the Agriculture Committee. Congressman Hebert of Louisiana was chairman of Armed Forces. And Congressman Wilbur Mills of Ways and Means. All three were taken out of office. Mills resigned, but he resigned simply to avoid being replaced publicly. In addition to that, we have set up a whole new set of rules within the committee system. Instead of having a chairman, and even when I went to Congress, the situation was very bad. When I was elected in 1970, the situation was very bad. The committee chairmen were kings, and each of them had his own fiefdom, so to speak, over that he controlled. But today, committees must have a set of rules by which they operate. They're printed rules. they are accepted by the committee and then by the House of Representatives at the beginning of each session. They must operate according to them. Any single member of the committee may make a point of order on observance of the rules. All meetings must be open to the public unless a majority of the members present and voting. A majority must be present, and they must vote by majority to close a meeting for a specific purpose. You can only close a single meeting. You cannot close more than one meeting. Chairmen are elected in secret ballots. This was started in 1973. The committee, subcommittee chairmen are all confirmed by the entire House. There is no, all votes are made public in all committee meetings. All proceedings of all committee meetings, unless they're closed by majority vote, are, for security reasons or personnel reasons, are public record. There's no such thing anymore as a closed rule. What we call a closed rule, one of the greatest shocks of my life as a congressman came just after I was elected, before I was sworn in. I went back to Washington, D.C. to help rent a house and get ready and get acquainted. There's no such thing anymore as a closed rule. What we call a closed rule, one of the greatest shocks of my life as a congressman came just after I was elected, before I was sworn in. I went back to Washington, D.C. to help rent a house and get ready and get acquainted. And I was taken on the floor by Congressman Tom Foley, and Congressman Wilbur Mills, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, had a tax bill out on the floor. And Mills had a way of writing his bills in his own, with his own staff in the back room. He'd hold hearings for a few weeks on something, and then there'd be nothing said. He'd just adjourn the hearings, and there'd be silence. And then one day he'd call a meeting of the committee, and the committee members would attend, and there'd be a copy of the bill, all printed in final form on every member's desk. And he'd say, this is the bill that the committee has prepared on this subject on revenue taxation. Chair would entertain a motion for acceptance. All of them say aye, bang, the meeting's adjourned. Then he would go to the Rules Committee and ask for a closed rule. Now, a closed rule means you bring the debate, the bill out on the floor, but it can't be amended. The Congress must take it or leave it. And just vote yes or no on the entire bill. You can debate it for 4 hours all you want to, but ultimately you can only vote on final acceptance. And this was called a closed rule. Mills brought such a bill to the floor, and some of the members objected. And he said, we can't have an open rule and allow amendments because it'd be all trimmed up with special interest amendments to favor certain groups who want special tax preferences. So at this point, the opponents came up with, an extremely clever ruse. They said, we propose an amendment which will allow us only to delete things from the bill, but not to add anything to it. In other words, to take out some of the things that Mills put in. And they said, we'll forego any right to add anything if we can have the right to take something out. And Mills stood up on the floor, and I can only paraphrase what he said, but he said, if this amendment to the rule passes and you allow amendments to my bill, I will take my bill back to committee and you'll never see it again. And he meant what he said, and the House caved in and gave him his way. Now, that's just not possible today. Today, any 50 members, by simply signing a petition, can force an open rule on any bill, an unlimited rule for any amendment on any bill. And so that power is taken away. So it's really a great deal of change has come in the last 4 years in the House of Representatives, and it's all been for the good. And of course, this year we're writing a budget. For the first time in history, the House is writing a budget. And it's a trial balloon. And it's on-the-job training this year. But in fiscal 77, we will have complete responsibility for writing the budget for the first time in history. Instead of an executive office, with a completely anonymous people writing a budget, the Congress is doing it itself. So those changes have been very important. And along with that, of course, is campaign finance reform, which virtually eliminates any secret financing of any campaigns today, which is another weapon that committee chairmen used, even with respect to their own members, to keep in mind. I see a hand over here, yeah.
Yeah, this last January or December, when you were changing some of the chairmen, I believe a man named Wayne Hayes was first voted out in the caucus or something, and then was later reinstated. The way I interpreted this in the newspaper was that he through his position, he was able to coerce power appeal by taking in charge of procreation. And was this a true representation of the situation? Is, like, were members susceptible or to voting for him because otherwise they would lose funds? Or was this a distortion of the case?
It was a mild distortion. I think there's an element of truth to it. But the fact was, it was a secret ballot. He would have no way of retaliating anybody except by guessing who voted how. But you have to have somebody, in ultimately, who's in charge of handling in-house funds. Somebody has to be the accountant, and that's Wayne Hayes. And if he wants to disapprove somebody's staff, he can do it, and then it's a tremendous fuss to overcome it. Hayes is a typical kind of a guy who is a ruthless master of this stuff. And it takes a very tough-minded person to handle these funds, to say no to people. And he is a tough SOB, that's all you can say about him. The press said that he coerced people, but actually it was more that he just went with them and went to them and convinced them, look, you guys, I have to be tough, I have to be rough, I have to do this job this way. He did appear before these groups and persuade them, but it was still a secret vote. It was a mix of both.
Could you comment on first whether what the foreign travel junkets that we read about, what the rules are in regard to that, and whether changes are being made in the freedom in that area?
Well, this, I think, is one of the most, I want to start by saying Congress is not perfect. It's made by human beings. And as Abby Stevenson said, he said, politics is like a pump. It pumps up a cross-section of American people into positions of prominence. I'm inclined to think it's better than that, but you do get people who are dishonest and corrupt and stupid in positions of responsibility, and sometimes they're very conspicuous. But as far as foreign travel is concerned, my only reaction to it is, it's just work like the rest of the jobs we do, only it's worse because you lose sleep and you suffer jet lag and you're going all the time. This idea of junketeering around and having fancy parties and all the stuff that Hollywood dreams up about foreign trips is just mainly figments of people's imagination. Once in a while, somebody does something indiscreet. Once in a while, somebody demands or something that they shouldn't be demanding overseas, goes to the State Department and insists on some sort of preferential treatment. But this is a very rare exception. We do have to get around. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples of trips that I've been on. This end of June, we went to visit the nuclear breeder programs in Scotland.
When you say we, don't include
me. Margaret didn't go along. I went with a committee of four congressmen and 10 staff people, all scientists, who went to Europe to visit the nuclear breeder programs in England, France, and Germany. And we left at 7:30 on Saturday night, arrived in London 7:30 Sunday morning, transferred planes in London, arrived at Scotland at noon, went to bed, got up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and went out for, hired a minibus and went out and drove around to Loch Lomond, which is about 20 miles away, and had dinner. Came back, went to bed. We were just staying at a regular motel. We had no State Department and no military escorts at any time, the entire time, except the science attaché and the State Department would come down to be sure that we were meeting the right, our right hosts, and that we had heavy language barriers if we were in a foreign language country. We got up at 5 o'clock the next morning, clear up the tip of Scotland to Dunray, to their breeder station. We're up there all day, flew back again, a little airplane that flies way up almost the Arctic Circle, back down to Glasgow that night, and on down to Manchester. That night, we had the beginning of our lunch in Glasgow and managed to finagle some dessert in Manchester about 10 o'clock at night. We're up at 8 o'clock. We're out at 8 o'clock. We're up in time for an 8 o'clock meeting at Risley, which is the British AEC headquarters. The next morning, we were with them all day, flew from there to London, to Paris, to Marseille, and got to Marseille at 10 o'clock at night, all on private commercial airplanes, drove by private automobile to Avignon, that night at midnight, I had dinner with Pizza Pie at Avignon. Got up the next morning, and we got an hour to see Avignon, walking around. Getting up at 6, we could have 1 hour to see that. We drove to Marcoul to see the breeder, went to Cataract, which was 2 hours' drive, 2 hours more back to Marseille, flew back to Paris that night, and at 10 o'clock had dinner. I actually went walking on the Champs-Élysées about midnight. Up in the airplane next morning, 8 o'clock, to go to Cologne, spent that day in Bonn, and we finished that day. And the last day, we said to our German hosts, when they said, "Is anything we can do for you?" We said, "Yes." I said, "Yes." I was the chairman of this trip. I said, "I don't know what your schedule is, but every hour, on the hour, we want a break where we can stand up, walk around, stretch, breathe, and wash our faces." That, you know, that time we were that tired. Now, the entire trip, we did not have a steak dinner. It did not have any of these things that Hollywood portrays about foreign trips. We arrived back. We had the 4th of July. We actually took the 4th of July off. And I drove down to Bavaria and went sightseeing for a day and flew back and got home exactly a week after we left, almost to the hour.
But what are the congressional rules?
The rules are that the committee makes its decisions and that they're all public. That's it.
But there is no rule as to how busy it has to be.
No, it has to. No, it's just up to members. But there are very few members that have time to do any playing around. Now, Margaret and I are going to Japan next week. In this instance, I was invited by a private foundation working with the Japanese government to come to Japan because they wanted me over there for a conference dealing with a number of subjects, but part of it is energy. And I told them I wouldn't go. I told them I wouldn't go several times. I told them I wouldn't go unless it took Margaret along. And they upped the ante some more. And finally, I said I won't go unless Margaret can go all the way and just first class for both of us because I'm on vacation. I don't even want to go in the first place. And so finally I said, okay, and so we're going to go. It doesn't cost the taxpayers a single cent. It just costs us a week out of our vacation that we'd prefer to spend down here at Chelan, laying on the dock. But we're going to go because we think it's a desirable thing to do, a thing that we should do. I think this business of junkets has been badly distorted. The worst place in the world for us to try to make decisions is sitting in Washington, D.C. looking at each other. All of us sitting around, just like as if people in this room, those of us in this room, spent all of our time in this room looking at each other and trying to pass bills on laws that affected things out there someplace, 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 miles away. It's really important to get out and look and find out on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
When the election took place, recently, there was a host of new congressmen with reform-mindedness, unseating a lot of old veterans. And there was a lot of anticipation, a lot of hope, and quite what you said about the reform. But when I was just picking up a wrong press, I sense a disillusion in the Congress, even among some of the congressmen who had hoped for so much. And a lot of talk about weak leadership, unable to get enough votes to muster enough votes to override vetoes and so on. What a comment on that?
Yes, I would like to comment on that. I think a lot of this, in the first place, was second-rate press coverage. In the first place, we did have a lot of freshmen elected, and a lot of them are very, very young and with very little experience, some with no experience at all. And they came to Washington, D.C. with all sorts of grand ideas about literally rebuilding the earth in 7 days. They just have all kinds of things they were going to do right now. And they learned after time that the system just doesn't work that way. It isn't possible. And they, since their realities have fallen somewhat short of their rather, I think, adolescent dreams, some are disillusioned. And we have a few pressmen who talk the same way. But when one talks about what reforms they would have instituted, what they would have changed, they sort of look at you, they don't really have anything to say. I've done this. I said, well, what would you have done differently? And there's a sort of a pause and sort of a confused look because they don't really know. The fact is that the House has not had the strong leadership that it had under people like Sam Rayburn. And people say, why doesn't the House or the Senate have this autocratic leadership that it's had in the past? I think the answer is because people don't really want it. They want the Congress to be much more open and much more democratic. and the more open and more democratic it is, the less regimented and efficient it's going to be. It just, the two are just not compatible. Now, in the election time, somebody started talking about a veto-proof Congress. I don't know who, but it wasn't any responsible member of Congress. And some of the press picked it up, and some people in campaigns picked it up. But there never was a veto-proof Congress, and there was never any serious thought of having a veto-proof Congress. As a matter of fact, the Democrats have exact, I think it's 2-1, I think it's one more than two-thirds, and maybe it's exactly two-thirds of the votes in the House of Representatives. But we all know that the party system is very weak, and that the Southern Democrats frequently defect from the Democratic Party, taking away about one-sixth or so of the votes on many issues. And on the Republican side, there are a couple of dozen to 30 Republicans who frequently desert the Republican Party on partisan line votes. Now, on the vetoes, you can put the vetoes generally into two categories, those that involve social reform and those that do not. Those that involve social reform or social causes, the Democrats have won. That we overrode the veto on the health bill the other day, and we will override the president's veto on the Education Appropriations Act when we go back on September 9th. I'm virtually certain we'll beat him on that. We beat him on the veterans benefits bill, and we beat him on his wanting to increase the cost of food stamps. These things where you have people involved, social legislation, education, handicapped people, health, welfare, mm-hmm. this sort of thing, that the Congress overrides presidential vetoes. Where he has won this year has been on oil pricing. And this is a matter of great philosophical difference between the Democrats on the one hand and the president on the other. But he's able to bring along about 125 of 140 Republicans with him and pick up oil state Democrats. And for this reason, he's now vetoing the extension of the oil price control, which will keep the price of old oil down. And I doubt if we can override that veto. Now, it's just as much a philosophical issue with those of us outside of the oil states. It's a profoundly important point. But the lines change at that time. The strip mining bill, well, we only missed by 3 votes. And in this case, he was able to pick up congressmen from coal states, along with, again, the most Republicans, and enough congressmen from coal states who were saying our economy is going to be crippled if the veto is not sustained. But you see, here the Congress voted about 66.2 or something like that to override the veto, and we failed by those 3 votes.
Okay, I think, are you about to ready to leave?
I want to ask a question. He and then after your remarks last night, what is your own feeling about a tax on energy now? The Ford Foundation, of course, came out in favor of it. I don't know how you voted on the gas tax. I know how my own congressman voted. What's your own feeling about it?
Well, I voted against all taxes on gasoline. I think they're silly. If we want to raise money, we can do it. If we just say, okay, gang, we want more money. Greater revenue, then we can tax gasoline, or we can increase income taxes, which would be fair. Let's see, what's the rest of your question?
Well, the Ford Foundation report recommended a tax on all forms of energy, gasoline, electricity, everything.
All right, I think if one wants to say that, if we're going to tax energy, it's much more fair to tax all energy, electricity, gas, and everything else. But energy is very basic to the standard of living, and it works a hardship on these low-income people. I think there's one thing I would say in response to your question, something I haven't said so far today, but it answers your question too, and that is that most of us are extremely sensitized by the economic plight of the senior citizens in this country. You know, I receive a copy of a letter that it's almost as if somebody mimeographed it and passed it out and said, sign this and send it in, and it comes to me week after week after week. It just constantly comes. And it goes like this. And says, Dear Congressman, my wife and I, or my husband and I, retired 5 or 3 or 7 or 10 years ago. We spent all our lives helping build this country. We raised our kids and put them through college. We fought the Depression and the Second World War. We built our home. We built a retirement program, and we retired with dignity. And now we're being wiped out by inflation and high medical costs and the cost of living. you get variations on these themes. This is what the letters say over and over again. These usually come in scrawled handwriting. You can tell it's a person whose hand isn't too steady, and they're writing out of desperation. And I had one that came to me about 18 months ago, I think. And at the bottom of this letter, which is written in ordinary black ink, the gentleman who signed it had taken a big red pencil and just wrote across in big red letters, "What did we do wrong?" Now, we are really sensitive to this problem. Incidentally, I answered him. I said, "What you did wrong was put your faith in an economic system that says a little bit of inflation every year is okay." Mm-hmm. Because that is really the problem that this country is facing as far as our standard of living is concerned and our retirement programs are concerned. The 3%, the economist's concept of 3% inflation every year is all right. Because 3% inflation over 30 years is a catastrophe. And this is the problem we're facing today. But we're very sensitive about putting regressive taxes on. And so I draw back from putting a tax on energy. I have more and be more inclined to get the reforms we want through on the income tax program and then increase the rates to provide the right what we need. I think it's a fallacy to assume that we can control energy consumption in the marketplace, that we can control it by raising the price. We've almost doubled the price of gasoline, and we have not significantly changed the rates, the amount that we consume. And so, from a philosophical standpoint, I don't have any real interest in that approach.
We're getting near. Did you have another question, Rudy, or we can ask it up
there? I just wanted to ask Margaret.
Yeah, I was going to have Margaret say it.
Yeah, sorry, Evan. Thanks so much. Yeah. I expected you guys to
ask her. What do you find most fulfilling in your role?
My one word for Washington, D.C. is it's exciting. And any aspect you want to look at it, if it's just going to the grocery store with your little two-wheel cart and dragging your grocery sack home, it's a different way of life than I'm sure any of you live in any of the hometowns that you live in. It's a traumatic thing to be wrenched from your home and your friends and a job. I happen to have been working, and we had two children living at home, and we yanked the nest out from under them, and off we went to Washington, D.C. They did not wish to go with us. They wanted to stay in the state and did, and are scattered around the country now. But I think particularly the women in the group can understand what a difficult moment in your life that is. And, you know, things will never be the same again. I think one joke among the wives in Washington, D.C. is the question, "What did you do when you first came?" And the answer is, "I cried a lot." And, of course, you laugh as you say it. But I'm sure that most of us did some crying. I think I did mine before I left or on the way back. And then had done with it, and you go on living a new life. It's tremendously exciting to be there, to be part of that life, to meet the people that you're able to meet and see the Congress in session, to know the activities that are going on and the crushing importance of the decisions that are made there and the difficulty with which these people get down and they're torn every which way, and yet you have to come to some final decision. And I think most of us wish that things were black and white, and I think maybe 50 years ago things were in blacks and whites, and you could easily see what was the correct way to go, and you generally speaking chose to go that way. I think today our problems are in shades of gray, and you don't know which direction to go, and you choose a direction and hope that it'll solve the major parts of the problems before us. And if that doesn't work, I think our society is changing so quickly. What is an answer 1 year or 2 or 3 years later? That problem's altogether different, and you need a different answer. And again, that answer is hard to come by. So I just find it challenging to be there, I guess, and the wives do a lot of things. We do more social things than the men do, by any means.
She knows what's inside of all those museums.
Yes.
And places. Where would the women go during the daytime?
I recommend Washington, D.C. as a marvelous place to vacation.
But not in the summer.
Right, not in the summer, if you can possibly avoid it. But I can talk I can talk about the things I've done for about 2 hours nonstop, and it's a very different talk from the talk that Mike gives. It's from the way that I've seen Washington, D.C. Just very quickly to tell you a little bit about it, as the congressman's wife, I am automatically a member of what was called the 92nd Wives Club. Mike is was a member of the 92nd Congress, and so I'm a member of the 92nd Wives. And other women will come up to me and say, "What club are you a member of?" And I say, "I'm 92nd." And then that tells them where I am in this chain of activity, whether they've come after me or before me. And these women get together. The previous club, then, the 91st Club, was in charge of our orientation. And we don't know who we are or who each other is, but they do. And they get our addresses and so forth and invite us then to a series of about 10 or 12 activities starting every Wednesday about 10 o'clock in the morning. And then we tour some facility there in D.C. I've gone through the Pentagon and been in the hot room where the hotline is between Washington, D.C. and Russia. It's a very interesting, very small room, and always has a Russian linguist in charge. And I've been there twice, and both times the Russian linguist was a woman, and I found that interesting. I've been through the Capitol building. Of course, it's such a marvelous, exciting place to be and to walk through and know everything that's happened in that building. The Library of Congress is another magnificent building that I think you can all be just terribly proud when you hear those words, the Library of Congress. It's a beautiful building in itself, and they're just finishing a second extension of that building, a new one, the James Madison building. They just can't put everything in one building anymore. And the second one was made it adequate for a while, and now they need a third major. It's a whole block that's been taken up by this one building, about four basements and four or five floors that will all be made specifically for preservation of written work, maps, pictures, and so forth. And then one of the last things this group does is go through the White House, and that's a very marvelous experience to be in the White House, and you sort of have to pinch yourself to realize where you are and why you're there. And so I've done many interesting things, and then of course our group had the responsibility for the orientation of the 93rd Wives, and you always want to do a good job for them because you appreciate so much what the group before you did for you. They make you feel somewhat at home in Washington, D.C. They allow you to meet other wives who are having very similar experiences. It's one of these funny activities. Either you brought your children with you and you have the problems of schools and coping with them making friends and living in new neighborhoods and so forth, or you've left your children behind and you're trying to raise them over the telephone, which is quite an experience, or you're older and your children are already married and out, and then I find the women miss their grandchildren. And I thought this was very interesting, that these women were moping around and saying, you know, I'm missing seeing my grandchildren grow up, or they're growing while I'm away from them. So you have various problems, sort of family problems. And I think the women are very active in sort of keeping the family together. The men are so busy they don't have time for that. And, anyway, you can see we have a really an interesting life. But some people say, what would you do if Mike said, let's go home? I said, I'd race him for the suitcases.
Let me say one thing about Margaret, if I may, and that is that we never know, well, almost never know when we're going to have dinner. I may call up in the afternoon and say, I'll be home at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. I may call up and say, I'm bringing somebody home. I may call up and say, how soon can you get dressed to go out? They want us to be someplace at 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock. There she is. She has to constantly change schedule, have dinner ready, put it back in the freezer, do this sort of thing.
Be dressed elegantly to go out and having to call and say, we're still in session, we won't go.
the constant pressure of keeping clothes ready. The ability to have me call up and say, hey, we just got 10 people from home, and yeah, I've got them on my hands, and they're from the district, and we got to be nice to them. Can I bring them to the house? And this sort of thing.
You may be out painting the back fence and, you know, be really not ready, but you say, sure. And
or to call her up and say, the secretary's sick. Can you come up and be the receptionist for this afternoon? This is the sort of thing that we depend on for Margaret. And then, of course, it's always the business of trying to know as many of the people. You know, the Washington Society, there's thousands of people, and you try to get acquainted and try to, you know, to be responsible and to be gracious. It's a real challenge, and it takes a real team effort. And so I can't pay enough tribute to Margaret or all the rest of the congressional wives that do it. May I just say one thing? Margaret says one thing. I want to make very specific condition of one thing she said. I'm going to write a newsletter to my constituents, which is going to say something like this. I hope you'll all participate in the bicentennial in every way that you can. It's a wonderful experience, and we should do everything we can to commemorate the bicentennial. But don't try to come back to Washington, D.C. during the summertime. If you try to come to Washington, D.C. during the summertime, you cannot find a place to live, you cannot find a place to park your car, you cannot find a toilet, you cannot find a place to eat. The heat and humidity and pollution are overwhelming. Don't come. If you want to come in October or April, that's wonderful. I just want to make that point for you. As much as I think everybody should see Washington, D.C., don't come in the summertime, particularly not next summer.
Okay.